come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The world is full of conflict, and one of the areas that has been more conflicted than most, especially in recent years, but in fact going back over the last century, is that part of Europe known as Ukraine, an area from which my ancestors on my mother's side very wisely escaped before the turn of the 20th century. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest today is raising an issue that most of us kind of forgot about, I think, after the 1970s, the fall of the Berlin Wall in the 80s. But perhaps it is reared its head once again, and that is the threat of a nuclear Russia. He's the author of numerous books that we've talked about here on this program, Lying Wonders of the Red Planet, Power Quest Volumes 1 and 2, Uncommon Sense. His most recent book, an e-book, is Russia Destined to Nuke the United States? He's also the author of a piece about the conflict in Ukraine, posted at Skywatch Magazine as of today. It is our pleasure to welcome back to the bunker our friend Doug Woodward. Doug, it's good to talk with you again.
Hey, Derek, thanks for having me once again on your show and a chance to talk with you and your audience. I really appreciate it.
The Ukrainian conflict. My ancestors are German, but they emigrated to that area, what is now Ukraine and Moldova. And in fact, there's a Moldovan separatist movement that none of us have really heard about, which is also part of what's happening over there. The government in Kyiv is basically facing separatist movements in the east, the Russian-backed folks there, and in the west. Also backed by Russia to some extent. It is, frankly, it's a mess. It's the site of a proxy war really taking place between the Russia or the American backed or Western backed government in Kyiv and the Russian backed rebels in the eastern part of the country. And things are just really seeming to spiral there. Yesterday on Skywatch TV, I talked about, how the government, militias, the ones that are fighting to keep Ukrainian appear to be neo-Nazis, and they're calling on the help of some Islamic militants from Chechnya, which is disturbing. This is a fight that Russia seems very keen not to lose. Let's dig into this a little bit. What is the background? Why does Russia care, and why is Vladimir Putin so intent on making sure that the Russians come out ahead in this particular conflict? Where could this lead?
Well, thanks. I appreciate that setup. There's really a lot of different threads. And we talk in the article that with your help and your able assistant, your wife, we're published on Skywatch Magazine just today. In fact, listeners will want to look at that and kind of go through it systematically, because I really trace the history of this conflict. What we might want to do is let me talk just briefly about kind of where we are right now, what happened recently, and then take a broader, almost a 200-year historic take on this to give people a sense of why this is, why this is historically important. And the first thing I would say, though, just as kind of the overall context is the event, are the events in Ukraine likely to lead to some type of nuclear conflict between either Russia and NATO or Russia and the United States, specifically putting the United States homeland at risk? And my answer is yes, it is a real concern, and one that we need to be very watchful on. And our government and our military needs to be very watchful right now. First, the most notable event is the fact that a number of months ago, over a year ago, Russia annexed the Crimea. The Crimea is a little peninsula that extends from southern, southeastern Ukraine out into the Black Sea. And there is really one overarching reason why Russia must that peninsula, why it must control Crimea, and it's because of a naval base that they have in the Black Sea, a city called Sevastopol, and it is a naval base that historically Russia has had off and on, but more on than off, for almost 200 years. So it is historic. When Putin says historically that Ukraine is their land and Crimea is a part of Russia, there he has a reason why he says that. And he's not completely off base. We're going to talk a bit more about why he is partially off base, though, in this. But the first thing is to understand there's a naval base. This is where Russia's submarines are, that's their port. That's their port of call. And so that's where most of the Russian Navy, although it's aging, they only have one aircraft carrier, but that's where its port is. And just to give folks, some context, the Black Sea through another little sea of, I think it's called Marmola, but it has to do, it's a Greek word for marble, because there's a little island where marble is in fact abundant, and it's through that that passageway that that Russia is able to slip into the Mediterranean, and so it gives them in effect access to a warm water port, which they've always wanted historically. Yeah, they have ports on the Baltic Sea and the far north, but they want warm water ports, and so it gives them access to commerce as well as military advantage. Make the comment about the aircraft carrier. Important for listeners to understand that the United States has 19 aircraft carriers. It has carriers, 10 large aircraft carriers that are manned by the Navy, and 9 aircraft carriers that are manned by the Marine Corps. All right, they're smaller carriers. Comparing, let's say, the one Russian aircraft carrier that which was built, I think it was finalized, it was designed and thought about long ago, but it was finally commissioned, I believe, in like 1991. So it is not a nuclear carrier, meaning that it runs by old-fashioned oil as opposed to some type of nuclear reactor. But it moved into the Mediterranean to sort of counter the move of the U.S. Navy with the aircraft carrier George H.W. Bush. The Kunetsov is able to supply a series of fighters. About a dozen fighters is what it can hold and what it can amass and support from its aircraft carrier. In comparison, the H.W. Bush can handle 60 American fighters. So America has the ability with its single aircraft carrier to Now, the little entourage that the Kunetsov came in to the Mediterranean with included 5 other ships. One of those ships was a tugboat. The reason it was a tugboat is that the Kunetsov has a propensity to break down. And so the Russian Navy is not its strong suit. And as we'll talk later, the strong suit is its nuclear arsenal. It's essentially its only real strong suit. Both tactically and strategically. All right, now to jump a little bit more into the history, there are two victors to know about. There's a Viktor Yushchenko and a Viktor Yanukovych. Viktor Yushchenko, your listeners may remember, he was the Ukrainian president from 2004 to 2010, and he was the one purportedly poisoned by Russian spies with dioxin, which is one of the contaminants in Agent Orange. And he was horribly disfigured. His complexion has recovered quite a bit now. I don't know if the article in Skywatch has the pictures that I shared with you.
It does, Sean, yes.
But it does. Okay, so you'll see Yushchenko, and you'll see that he has sort of a heavily pitted face. But that's a nice picture compared to what he looked like about 18 years ago. Mm-hmm. So Yushchenko was president from 2004-2010. He became president in what was called the Orange Revolution. And Derek, I bet you are familiar with the color revolutions and the concept of the color revolutions.
Yes.
I don't know. Are you? Okay. I assumed that you were, because you're pretty politically up to date. But we'll come back and talk a bit about color revolutions in a minute and what that means to the Russians, because it has a lot of intrigue, to say the least. Well, anyway, Yushchenko and then the other Viktor Yanukovych, competed for the presidency. Yushchenko won in 2004. And then in 2010, there was a new election, and Yanukovych won. Both elections were judged to be fair, finally. And so Yanukovych was democratically elected. But in 2014, he essentially fled office, mm-hmm. Fled Kiev, and went to Moscow. Now, Kiev is geography in this discussion is critically important. You know, geography, you know, why do you understand? What do we have to do geography in school? Well, in terms of the Ukrainian issue, it is of the essence of the issue. Kiev is in western Ukraine, and most of the Russian support in the Ukraine, the Crimea, is in the east and the southeast. And it has to do historically with where Russians settled over the past two centuries. And the fact that you have Russian-speaking populations in the east and the southeast. Well, Yanukovych was leaning towards Moscow, and he was basically wanting to partner with Moscow. And again, your listeners may or may not be familiar with the fact that over the last 15 to 20 years, the Ukraine has been a plum that both Russia and America, the United States, and really NATO, have been trying to wrest control over. The United States has been for some time wanting to get Ukraine into NATO and to bring it into, in effect, the European common market. Ukraine is considered a European country. In fact, it's known as the breadbasket for Europe, very rich agricultural land. And Yanukovych was in Kiev, in western Ukraine, but he was leaning to the east. So he's somewhat isolated. Mm-hmm. So in February of 2014, there was some civil unrest, let's call it. The Russians claim that it was fomented by the CIA. The CIA claims that it was fomented by Russia. Mm-hmm. And in political diatribe going back and forth between these. And so today, you have Yanukovych who's fled. You have a government in Kiev that is loosely holding control over most of the Ukraine. But you have Russia doesn't admit, but they have put in at least 7,000, perhaps as many as 10,000 troops into eastern Ukraine. And there is conflict. Now, what really turned this from a local into an international crisis was the crash of the Malaysian airline about a year ago. The number escapes me. It's in my article.
MH17.
Mini study.
Yeah, MH17.
Thank you.
Was the flight.
And so it crashed. And what has been discovered and has been documented as Malaysian Air even says it's pretty conclusive that it was the Russian Buk missile, and that missile launcher requires significant training. So it was not just a couple of guys out there with their RPG that was able to shoot down a commercial airliner. So the question then is, why did this happen? And does this not prove that Russia was in fact trying to foment a war in the in the east of Ukraine? And of course, false flags. There's a lot of conspiracy nuts here in the United States, of which probably I'm one and you might be too, Derek.
Oh, yeah.
That we believe in false flags. Well, you know, the Putin believes in false flags as well. And so it's really hard to discern exactly who was responsible for the downing of that airliner, although supposedly Dutch have done an independent study in October. They're going to release a study that tells us, you know, who was responsible for the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner and killed over 100 people. So significant issue. So that kind of brought the issue into attention. Now, what's been happening really in the last 90, 120 days has been a tremendous amount of nuclear brinkmanship, where Putin has been talking. It really began back in March, but he's been talking about their nuclear weapons. He's been talking about the fact that they are a nuclear power. Their state TV has been talking in detail about how they are the one nation, the one power in the world that can turn America into a land of radioactive ash. Mm. And so there are very strong words. Putin has talked about the fact that he is willing to go to use nuclear war as a genuine weapon. There's tactical nukes, which really are the short-term, less powerful nukes. They could be artillery shells. They could be small rockets. They could be bombs dropped from fighter bombers like the F-15. So there's a lot of talk going back and forth, a lot of threats. Just recently, in the last 90 days, put in a advanced nearby in Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and the Russians countered again. This now we're in June. The Russians countered by announcing that they plan to put in place 40 new strategic ICBMs, and Putin boasted that those ICBMs could in fact get through any missile defensive system. And so it was a direct threat to the U.S. homeland. All right, I'll take a breath.
The United States military has, in spite of all the talk in recent days with about a nuclear Iran, prompted by the announcement of the finalization of a deal with Iran regarding its nuclear program, the U.S. military still considers, according to reports that I read just today, Russia to be its biggest threat, far bigger than Iran. The interviews that I've done with an expert in Islamic eschatology, Dr. Timothy Furnish, give me some reason to believe that the Ayatollahs in Iran have some religious basis based on their Shia faith to avoid using a nuclear weapon. And so I think that the military of the United States is probably on the right track, that Russia is something that is far more worrying as far as a strategic problem, a potential opponent in a conflict, than Iran is, which leads me to ask this question: why in the world have we been playing the games that we've been playing in Ukraine over the last 10 or 15 years? This goes back to the Bush administration and the Orange Revolution that you mentioned. We seem to have this theme of collaborating with. And this is the thing that really blew my mind and really helped me to understand that what we're dealing with here as far as Republican-Democratic politics in the United States is just pro wrestling in suits, people who fight like cats and dogs on TV and then go out for drinks afterward and laugh about
– Great analogy. Yeah, I love that.
And laugh, you know, because during the Bush administration, it was the Open Society Initiative, their institute, which is a George Soros organization that was receiving funds from the U.S. State Department, again, during the Bush administration, to finance and underwrite the Orange Revolution that brought Yushchenko to power in the first place. He was pushed out by the Russian candidate, the Russian-supported candidate, Yanukovych, who then was run out of town on a rail by the uprisings that took place in 2014. You may remember, you probably remember the phone call that was leaked by the government of Russia. They intercepted State Department official Victoria Nuland saying, bleep the EU, as she was discussing with a colleague who they were going to pick to be in the new yeah. Ukrainian government. The United States was basically saying, okay, here's who's going to sit in the halls of power in Kyiv and implement our policies and blank the EU. We don't care what they want. Knowing that Russia, and I think, you know, geography is key, as you said here, Doug, Ukraine is on the Russian border. Ukraine is on the Russian border. And for us to be playing a game in Ukraine, regardless of what we think about Vladimir Putin, we have to think that, you know, if I were in the Russian military, a Russian military strategist, I would look at Western influence in Ukraine with about as much approval as we here in the U.S. would look at Russian interference in, say, Mexico.
Cuba.
There you go. Drawing an
1962 analogy. All over again.
Exactly. What are the links there? Do you see a parallel between the Cuban Missile Crisis when we told Russia to stand down, we wouldn't tolerate their influence 90 miles off our shore, with what's happening, with what we're doing on their borders in Ukraine?
No, absolutely. I've been doing a lot of research. I don't go into all of the research in the this new study that I've released. By the way, it's both an ebook and a printed book if people want to be able to look at it.
Okay.
It'll be available starting August 1st on at Amazon and other places. But nevertheless, there are lots of parallels, lots of issues. 1962, when Kennedy and Khrushchev were going at it over the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis, it really was a coming of age of so many factors, but certainly the military-industrial complex became front and center. Kennedy was able to barely overturn the Curtis LeMays and the other generals of the Joint Chiefs that were keen to, in fact, go ahead and do a first strike, just like in the movie Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite things to talk
George
about.
George C. Scott. We'll lose
Strangelove.
We'll lose 20, 30 million tops.
Tops, yeah. You know. And, Strangelove is there's a very intentional comparison between Strangelove and Henry Kissinger, who at the time was doing World War III planning for Dulles at the CIA.
Yeah.
You may not be aware of that, but that's,
I was not,
met
but
Kissinger.
That's, yeah. But yeah, that, yeah. That's brilliant.
And so, yeah. And so, anyway, so there was a serious, plan to do a first strike against the Soviet Union. And so the Soviets, of course, knew that. And so they were fearful that Kennedy did not have control of the military. They believed he was already, in effect, just a titular figure, and that the Joint Chiefs were absolutely running the country. And so that was kind of what was playing in Khrushchev's mind. And so there was a point where it became clear that Kennedy was still in control, but it was tenuous. And so, in effect, Khrushchev may have made the decision in part to help ensure that a civilian government stayed in place in America and that it did not allow the military to, take over. And there was a movie at that time called The 7 Days of 7 Days in May.
Burt Lancaster.
And, Burt Lancaster is a Frankenheimer film, very important, talking about a coup d'etat. And it was all over this whole issue, you know. So we kind of fast forward now to today. Well, you know, Russia has had to live with nuclear missiles on its borders, where they're basically 7 minutes from Moscow. You know, they've had to live with that 50 years. And we didn't like living with it when they were 90 miles away from us in Cuba. And there is, in fact, then this sort of, the same kind of fear. It's kind of like, hey, you guys should have a taste of your own medicine. But the other thing is that there's two or three other real important dynamics here. One is that that's been 50 some years ago. So almost everyone that was alive and has a pretty vivid memory of that, those that are like 60, basically 60 and older, we kind of remember the Cuban Missile mm-hmm. Crisis. We kind of remember calculating how far it was and all that. Most of the folks that run this country now don't have that memory. And the same holds true to a great extent in Russia. So there's not a memory of the fear of brinkmanship, of using nuclear weapons as a way to play chess. Mm-hmm. And so there's that factor. There's another factor that the nature of the nuclear weapon itself has changed. It's more controllable. It's more targetable. It's scaled based upon the size that's needed for a particular blast. So your tactical nukes can be 2 to 20 kilotons, let's say. They can be packaged up in suitcases, or they can be delivered with artillery shells. These things were all tested back in the late 50s and 60s, and so the technology's been around. But it's one of the factors, though, that just the packaging and the production of these things, it makes both sides believe that the threshold for going nuclear has been reduced dramatically. So the potential to use nuclear weapons in the minds of our military, in the minds of their military, it doesn't hold the same sort of fear and trauma that it did for us back in the Cold War, back in the 60s, and even to some extent in the 70s. And so there's that kind of factor. There's also the factor that tactical nukes aren't included in the START treaty. And so tactical nukes are essentially uncontrolled. And so it's no surprise that Russia has probably something of the order of 25,000 tactical nukes, of which 2,000 are in the European theater to, in effect, protect the long Russian border, whereas NATO has only one-tenth that many tactical nukes, about 200 tactical nukes, in Europe available to use if Russia decides to start sending its new T-14 tanks across the border and so forth. So tactical nukes come into play. The issue of nuclear brinkmanship had been retired. It scared both countries to death, but that fear has dissipated. Mm-hmm. And so you've got militaries now willing to consider it as actually a tactic they can use.
It's like a former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright said, what's good of having the greatest army in the universe or in the world if you can't use it once in a while? Which of course is insane, but you need to have a bit of insanity, I guess, to want that kind of power at that level of government. So the brinksmanship then taking place in Ukraine, which seems to me, based on a recent analysis I read, I mentioned Victoria Nuland earlier, it appears that she buys into the sort of project for the new American century doctrine that America is the world's lone superpower. We need to flex our muscles in order to extend the American empire around the globe. And I guess that's not a surprise because she's married to Douglas Kagan, who is one of the members, one of the founders of PNAC, and very definitely a neocon. This neocon influence crosses political boundaries here in the United States. Democrats were fond of calling Republicans neocons, but they've essentially continued the same foreign policy under Barack Obama. And it appears that Ms. Nuland was one of the key instigators in what's been going on in Ukraine, at least this go-round of the Western right. influence. How would something right. like this then, what would it take to trip that wire and turn this from a game of words, a war of words, if you will, into an actual shooting match?
Mm. It's a good question. Certainly people in the military would probably have a more astute answer than my own. There are factors that, they're coming into play here. And probably, the real factor might be, what is Saudi Arabia doing with the price of oil? And are they, why are they doing what they're doing, where they're trying to push the price of oil down?
Right.
Are they doing that, for instance, to hurt the American oil industry that's gone crazy over fracking? And are they trying to make it economically unfeasible to use fracking? In Oklahoma these days, we're concerned about fracking because we are now the center of the most earthquakes in the United States.
Which is
unusual.
Of
course, our governor doesn't want to admit that fracking might have something to do with that.
Yeah.
So.
Now, see, and I had the opportunity to meet quite a few guys in the oil business in southern half of Illinois. And I did not realize that 100 years ago, southeast Illinois was the center of the American oil industry. Robinson, Illinois, which is almost on the Indiana border, about halfway down, it's about an hour south of Terre Haute or thereabouts, has an old Marathon oil refinery. And why would you put a refinery in Illinois instead of, somewhere like, Texas or Louisiana? It was because that's where they were drilling, and modern drilling techniques have allowed for a lot more extraction of oil in the southern part of Illinois. In fact, they think there's as much there as there is in western North Dakota in that Bakken formation. Guys in the business tell me that there's been fracking taking place in Illinois for 80 years, but not to the depth and not to the extent that they were hoping to get to if the price of oil had stayed over $100 a barrel. Right now, it's not cost effective for them to drill and exploit the resources that are there.
Correct.
And so they've not done the kind of drilling that's been taking place in Oklahoma.
Well, and so getting back to Saudi Arabia, and this is kind of a sidebar in a way, but the question is, what could trigger potentially an exchange? The point I would make is really flips around to Russia. Russia requires, Russia relies upon over oil and gas, oil and natural gas, and it exports it and it relies upon it for about 52% of its national revenue. The U.S. has income tax. The Russians use, basically, they own all of their own fossil fuels. U.S., it's privatized, right? Individual citizens own mineral rights, but not in most every other country in the world. Mm. It's a national, in effect, a national asset. And so the Russians sell oil and gas. They sell it through, and it runs through the Ukraine and pipelines, which is another factor. So the Russians have this leverage over the Europeans. But if you drop the price down, it has a huge impact upon the Russian economy.
Right.
The ability of Russia to build more weapons. The ability of Russia to put food on the table for its people. So you have some of the same old problems that the Soviet Union had 25, 30 years ago. And in part because, and of course, Putin owns Gazprom and some, the biggest Russian oil companies. He personally has an enormous stake Russia is extremely corrupt, and Putin is, you know, right at the forefront of corruption. Right now, you know, there's some people in the United States, the media, that hates Putin, but a lot of people, even evangelicals, kind of found Putin to be a very attractive figure because he's strong, he's a nationalist, things like that. But he's also a crook. He's probably one of the biggest crooks in the history of the world in terms of, probably has a net worth of over $40 billion, and almost all of it is through corrupt policies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a sidebar. But anyway, you have basically Saudi Arabia, you know, playing with the oil price and basically could be thumbing their nose at Obama for starting the Arab Spring. They could be trying to hurt Russia to remind them who really is the number one oil producer. So there's a lot of factors going on. And it's clearly becoming – Ukraine has been the focal point, but it quickly is going to not be about the Ukraine. I mean, Russia has what it mainly needs, which is Crimea. The U.S., to your point, about the sort of what we call the color revolutions, or what the Russian generals call the color revolutions. The U.S. really is the proponent for the New World Order, not Russia. George W. Bush was hoping that he could get Putin and others to participate, play along with the New World Order, to be friends. Remember when he looked into the eyes of Putin and could see his soul?
Yeah, Putin.
Yeah, well, you know. Yeah. What did you see when you look at us? You know, he was a man he could deal with. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's George Bush, George W. Bush. So, so there was a time, but Putin, of course, would have none of that. Putin wants to build back the old, Russia as a world power. And so as we sort of connect that back to this nuclear issue, I do in the study, I go through and talk about the different aspects of conventional warfare, and why Russia is not that strong. They have some great new things, some new attack subs, a new tank, a new aircraft, the Su-35. These are great conventional weapons, but they don't have them in mass, and they don't have enough money to build them in mass. And so it leaves them with where they put most of their money, which is in their nuclear weapons. And so Ian Bremmer was on Charlie Rose a couple weeks ago, and Charlie said, why is it that they're so fixated on their nuclear weapons? He thought for a second, he looked up at Charlie and says, it's because it's what they got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it is. That is their primary
weapon. It's the equalizer.
So if that's your only weapon, it is. It's the equalizer. And the reality is that there's some unofficial sources that have knowledge that I can't quote and can't cite, but our nuclear weapons, our defenses are far more vulnerable than we realize. Hmm. And of course, I argue, because I am an eschatology guy, that this whole issue of the conflict between the U.S. and Russia is very likely the conflict that's being discussed in both Jeremiah 50 and 51, as well as in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And that ultimately it's the Bible seems to be talking about the war between this series of great powers from the north and the daughter of Babylon, which is talked about in Jeremiah 50 and 51, that also is attacked by the great powers from the northern quarters.
Hmm.
And so ultimately it gets into that issue. And so the question really is, okay, well, is all the nuclear saber rattling that's going on right now, is that leading us up to some type of nuclear conflict between the United States and Russia? And my answer is yes, that seems to be the case. Now, will it happen this summer? Probably not. Could it happen in the next 2 to 3 years? The answer is probably very likely that it could. And again, it gets into these other factors, you know, the fact that their conventional military is not that strong, the fact that their economy is still on the edge, that the price of oil and gas has a big impact upon them, their economic viability. As you well know, Derek, United States essentially loves to sell its weapons worldwide. And for balance of power reasons, or rather payments, balance of payments, it forces other countries, be they China, be they Europe, to buy U.S. treasuries as a way of, in effect, synchronizing the out-of-balance situations in import-export, if you will. And so I'm getting ready to release an article probably later today that'll be entitled Why Europe Won't Defend Itself.
Hmm.
And the reason it won't defend itself essentially has a working agreement with everyone in the West that the U.S. will come to their aid and protect them from the boogeyman of China or Russia. And so Europe has no intention of defending itself or of complying with the NATO requirements that everyone spend at least 2% of their GDP on their military. Only the UK, by rethinking and recategorizing some of its expenditures, is able to hit the 2% requirement for NATO nations. And so only the US and Canada are the only nations that actually exceed the 2% GDP requirement for NATO. So, but actually the point is that there's a guy in Huffington Post that wrote this article yesterday that I'm responding to. Essentially, he doesn't understand the bigger picture. The bigger picture is that the United States is a war economy. The United States wants to build weapons. They want to foment revolutions, and they want to create the need for people to buy weapons. And so consequently, you know, we don't want Europe to defend itself. We want to defend it.
Right,
we want
right.
them to buy our weapons. We want them to be forced to buy our treasuries and to keep this, you know, this economy we've got going afloat.
You know, the more I look at history and compare the United States of today with Rome of 2000 years ago, the more I see parallels. I mean, it was very similar to Rome 2000 years ago. They didn't want their allied tribes or nations on their borders to be too strong because, again, they wanted the legions to have a place to go and operate because it was one means for Rome to enrich itself as a society, but also for ambitious generals and senators to carve out personal fortunes. And because they needed...
And you didn't want Roman armies this side of the Rubicon.
Yeah.
He didn't want them stationed in Rome. Very dangerous politically.
That is one difference, however, though. I mean, as we're recording this on July 15th of 2015, today the Jade Helm 15 exercise is beginning just south of you there in Texas. It appears that Posse Comitatus, which was the law enacted after the Civil War that prevented the military from being used for any kind of police activity inside the United States borders, has kind of gone out the window here in recent years, very quietly, like many of the other aspects of the U.S. Constitution that have been thrown out the window. Like, for example, the Senate having to approve foreign treaties by a 2/3 majority. Anyway, that's a whole nother issue.
But it's exactly right. I mean, Americans by and large are not aware of how their government has changed. And yet, you know, who's going to stop them? We're not going to stop them with our 6-shooter gun, you know.
Yeah,
our Second Amendment rights. Right?
Yeah. Let's talk about prophetically here for the remainder of the program. How would this scenario then play out? How would a potential conflict between Russia and the West, Russia and the United States in particular, fit into the prophecies of Jeremiah 50 and 51 and the Gog Magog conflict of Ezekiel 38-39?
Right. Well, the core issue is identifying who this character, the daughter of Babylon, is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's sort of a couple of schools of thought. One is that, you know, it's all past. It's all history. It doesn't have to do with anything in the future. So it's kind of a preterist view. And of course, you know, there's a lot of characteristics and attributes of the daughter of Babylon as described in Jeremiah 50 and 51 that really don't relate to the Babylon of the Old Testament or even the Babylon and not long after the Old Testament, Alexander the Great and so forth, which Babylon was his capital as well as the Medes and the Persians and before that the Babylonians. And so so it's been kind of the center, you know, of the Gentile kingdoms for a long time. But the daughter of Babylon seems to be sort of a mysterious entity or empire. And it has clearly has connections to Mystery Babylon of the Book of Revelation, and as you look at the passages in the Old Testament, not just Jeremiah 50 and 51, but Isaiah chapter 13, Psalm 137, Zechariah, I believe it's chapter 2, you see this phrase "daughter of Babylon," and then sometimes it's just Babylon, and then sometimes it's the land of the Chaldeans. And the question is, well, who is this? Who are we talking about? Now, another school of thought in today's world is that, well, we're talking about rebuilding the physical, historical Babylon in Iraq that's about 50 miles from Baghdad. And that still is a view. It's a view that Chuck Missler has, for instance, has embraced. Mm-hmm. It's a view that folks like a Waleed Shabbat or a Joel Richardson tend to embrace, that Babylon will be revived, it will be reinvigorated, it will become the center of world commerce, it will become the capital of the Antichrist. And that tends to go hand in hand with the view that Islam will be the basis of a one world religion, and that the Antichrist will be a Muslim. Okay. You know, myself, my co-authors in the book, The Final Babylon, we disagree with basically all those things. We don't believe the Antichrist will be Muslim. We don't believe the Jews would ever embrace a Muslim. We believe the Antichrist will be embraced by the Jews.
Right.
You know, if another, you know, I came in my name and you rejected me, another will come in his own name and you will accept him. And so there's this prophecy of Jesus that, that someday Jews will accept, in effect, an Antichrist figure. So we don't believe Antichrist will be Muslim. We don't really believe that it's that there's going to be any significant rebuilding of Babylon. Babylon is a tourist attraction, and it's Disneyland. It's not going to be the center of world commerce. Probably take 100 years for a city to be rebuilt, for the power structures to shift in the world, for commerce to shift away from Wall Street and from the city of London, and yeah. so on and so forth. So there's a strong argument against, I believe, against the concept of a historical Babylon. So then who is the daughter of Babylon? Who is Mystery Babylon? We believe it's the United States. To a lesser extent, it's Western society. It includes London and England in particular, to some extent, all of Europe. It is a little bit of the old Roman Empire idea of Hal Lindsey. But importantly, most eschatologists that are in the sort of pre-millennial, pre-tribulational view, they've tended to dismiss America as a player in Bible prophecy, believing that instead it's a revived Roman Empire. It will be in Rome. It includes the Roman Catholic Church and so on. That's kind of the traditional scenario. We reject that as well. We think that Rome has a part to play and has historically had a part to play as sort of the mystery religion that has a Babylonian heritage, a pagan heritage, and so forth. And so we are definitely Reformed Protestants. Right? nevertheless, we believe that the there are many references in Jeremiah 50 and 51 that specify that the daughter of Babylon is – it's a country of mingled people. In fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually read a little bit or just reference some of the scriptures here in my study. So there are a number of attributes. Some of the attributes would be, for instance, let's see here. I'm going to start up with Jeremiah 50:12. The daughter of Babylon is called the hindermost of nations. Hindermost is a specific word that really refers to the youngest and perhaps last in a series. It's like the final empire.
That would not fit.
That's why we want one of the reasons. Pardon me?
I was going to say that wouldn't fit with historical Babylon, which clearly had been around for quite some time. Yeah.
Clearly it would not. Jeremiah calls it in chapter 50, verse 23, the hammer of the whole earth. So it is a military power throughout the entire world. And, of course, the United States has something like 900 to 1,000 military bases stationed all over the world. Jeremiah 50, verse 12 and verse 37, Jeremiah 51:13 describes the daughter of Babylon as the richest nation in the world. So it basically dictates economic terms worldwide. So, and that's very much the case if you're, whether you're talking about the IMF or the World Bank. You know, it may be called the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, but essentially it's the fund that's assembled by Western bankers, predominantly American, to secondary extent, the European bankers. And again, that's, you know, a characteristic most of the United States. Most people don't realize the United States really financed Germany both in World War I and in World War II. So the U.S. has kind of followed an evil principle of basically financing European wars to weaken Europe to the point where the U.S. could basically be the most dominant nation in the world. Whether it started off that way as the plan or whether it was just, you know, it made good economic sense to loan money, probably isn't the point, but it's become kind of come to that. Jeremiah 50, verse 37, the daughter of Babylon is composed of a mingled people. and by mingled people, they're really talking about the fact that it's not a single race of persons, but it's a nation that is, in effect, a melting pot of multiple races. And, of course, that harkens to the motto of the Statue of Liberty. Mm-hmm. You know, give me your tired, your hoard, your poor, your humbled masses yearning to be free. It's a nation, Jeremiah 51:13, a nation that lives on many waters. Of course, the United States has three coasts, Pacific, Atlantic, and the Gulf, as well as the largest freshwater lakes in the world and massive rivers that divide the land, which also is a reference to Isaiah 18. Mm-hmm. It is a nation that has mounted up to the heavens, so even the sky is no limit. That's Jeremiah 51:53. It's a nation in which the nations of the world flow unto it. They stream unto him, Jeremiah 51:44. So all the nations of the world meet in this city or nation. What city could that be?
Yeah, New York City, of course. Well, United Nations.
Could be Vienna, but it's likely to be the United Nations and the New York City. It was once a golden cup in the Lord's hands, but it's now become a cup of sin and immorality, a cup of filthiness. And so, of course, then it's a nation from which the people of God are told to flee many times. I think it's six or seven times in the Old Testament. So that too would suggest that it's a nation that is not Babylon, not Iraq. Because today, how many Jews live in Iraq?
Practically none.
There were quite a few that virtually zero.
Same with Christians, as the Christian communities there have been decimated with the rise of the Islamic State.
Yeah, and so one of the arguments for the daughter of Babylon being Babylon itself, being in Iraq, there is no one to flee Iraq. The Christians and the Jews have either been killed or they've left. And so it's already, you know, that's already happened. Of course, one could say, well, then that was the fulfillment of the prophecy. But unfortunately, it doesn't fit all these other issues.
Right.
So there's over 60 different attributes. John Price, in his book, The End of America, does a nice job laying out about 30 of these specific prophecies, of which I talked about. And there's more, even in a little study I did that I'm not talking about now. But essentially, the prediction is that the daughter of Babylon is going to be destroyed. It's going to be destroyed by a series of lands or nations from the northern quarters. And that is the connection to Ezekiel 38 and 39, because there's very specific identification of a series of countries known as Gog and Magog, of Meshesh, Tubal, of other countries, Beth Togomar, and then the other Eastern and African nations, Persia, Put, which is probably Libya, could be Sudan. And so there's a series, Ethiopia is mentioned as well. Yeah. So there appears to be a massive conflagration, a confederacy of all of these nations that come against Israel in what is known as the sort of the war of the Messiah by the Jews. And we consider it, those of us that study eschatology and Christianity, we consider it the war that happens probably just before the tribulation period or the Daniel 70th week or just before the Great Tribulation or just after. It tends to be connected with the days of the Messiah, the very last of the last days, perhaps the last 7 to 10 years before Jesus Christ, we believe, physically, visibly appears again. And so it is it's a very crucial part of Bible prophecy. And again, as we study Ezekiel 38 and 39, you see these nations identified. This whole issue, by the way, of Gog and Magog, it's an area that hasn't really been talked about in about 10 years very much. There were a couple of great studies done around 2006, one by Douglas Berner called The Silence is Broken.
Yes, in fact, I interviewed Doug about that.
Another by Rhodes. Yeah. Okay. And then Ron Rhodes wrote a book, I believe it's called Northern Storm Rising. And so his book, so there's been kind of a dearth of interest in that. The last 10 years, we've had probably more interest in UFOs and giants and exopolitics. And, yeah, and I guess I'm leading the throng the campaign for geopolitics once again as being a vital portion of prophecy.
Well, just wrapping up, because that is key. And that's one of the things that I really respected about the analysis done by Chris White recently. Now, of course, he disagrees on the identity of the final Babylon. He identifies it as Jerusalem. Yes. But at least he does make the case that geopolitically, some of the analyses that have been done don't seem realistic in the modern geopolitical context. Your analysis, and to the extent that he factors in the unlikeliness, is that the word I wanted? Anyway, the improbability.
Improbability?
Yes.
Improbability?
That people in Israel would accept a Muslim antichrist into his analysis. I think that makes a lot of sense. Just to kind of put a bow on this and wrap this up, why do you think the possibility of a conflict with Russia is especially high, or at least more likely now than it maybe has been recently, and why the next few years would be a time frame for which to watch for something like this?
Yeah, certainly I can answer that from a geopolitical standpoint. You know, Russia has some real strategic decisions to make. They have to decide whether or not they can survive in a world in which America may be involved and responsible for many color revolutions, continuing to put Russia behind the eight ball, as it were. They have to decide whether or not they have enough control over oil and gas, their ability to make their economy work. They have to make that decision. They have to decide whether they really want to enter in an arms race with America. Khrushchev was very influenced when he came to America after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he looked at American industry and he realized that, you know, that fighting America with its industrial might was not something that the Soviet Union could do. And still, that's true today. America is still, despite our problems, is still the most powerful economic engine in the world. And so fighting on a sustainable basis over a long term with conventional war weapons is just not something that makes a good idea. It's not a good idea to take the United States on. It is the hammer of the whole earth. The only chance you have is a surprise attack. The only chance you have is to have weapons that we don't know about. It could be space weapons, but they could simply be very clever weapons. For instance, Russia has a new missile that travels essentially at Mach 10. It could be fired either from land or from sea. So any city in the United States is reachable within a few minutes by this kind of missile. And so the United States is very vulnerable. And when you look at we don't have time to go into some of the defenses of the United States and why they're more vulnerable because they're satellite-based. But Russia has an opportunity, and perhaps, you know, it's grim to say, gee, this is their only chance. But the reality is, if you look at all of the economic and geopolitical factors, it is almost the only chance Russia has to be a power in the world is to take on America in the short term. And because I also happen to believe that we are close to the return of Jesus Christ, I think that it's plausible that the scenario in the Old Testament is, in fact, what could happen in the years just ahead. Mm.
Doug Woodward's new article is posted at Skywatch Magazine, online at skywatchmagazine.com, Why the Ukraine Conflict Could Lead to World War III, and his new mini-study, Is Russia Destined to Nuke the U.S., will be released on August 1st. And Doug, where will people look for that?
Yeah, they'll be able to find it certainly on Amazon. They'll be able to find it on iBook, Nook, so all of the ebook formats, Lulu and so on. But certainly it'll be also a number of ministries will be selling the book, Southwest Radio Church. Don't know if Skywatch is. I had to talk with Tom to find out about that.
He's been
Prophecy Watchers will be.
Yeah, pardon me? He's been hard to get a hold of the last week or so. He's agreed to more speaking engagements,
I thought he was going to swear off on that. He didn't want to be that busy.
Well, in fact, I did see him today, and he said, you know, why do I keep saying yes to things that I don't want to do? But he's really good at it. That's why people keep asking him, because he's really good.
And he really does want to do them. It's just that they take a lot of time and energy.
Right, right. You know, and we're still in the process of getting getting things built up around here at Skywatch. In fact, people who are listening carefully to today's Skywatch TV news update will hear the banging of hammers and the noise of power saws in the background. So, we'll have to get in touch with Tom about this as well. Yeah. So we'll put a link to that, and also a link to your website, faith-happens.com, in the show notes. Doug,
yes.
Thanks for your analysis, and I think very timely, and as a news junkie and one who's been reading a lot about what's been going on in Ukraine, and again, one with sort of a family connection several generations removed, but at least an interest in that part of the world. I know you mentioned Catherine the Great in your article here. It was her invitation.
Yes. Yeah.
It was her invitation that motivated my ancestors to move from near Stuttgart, a little town called Markgräningen, to what is now today in near Odessa in Ukraine, and then eventually emigrated over across the river into what is now Moldova. They left at about 1894 for the Dakota territories.
Okay.
There are cousins that I've connected.
Probably good that they did. If they'd stayed in the Ukraine, we didn't get to talk about it, but Stalin basically eliminated 7 million Ukrainians in 1932, 1933.
Well, and actually, through Facebook, I actually have had the opportunity to meet and exchange some letters with a distant cousin whose branch of the same family stayed in Ukraine, but being ethnic Germans, when Stalin took power, they repatriated those Germans back into Germany.
That's interesting to know.
Yeah. So they got out of there, but you're right. There were Ukrainians who were literally dying in the streets and during the 30s, and this was when Time magazine was declaring Stalin Man of the Year. So they've had a rough time,
exactly.
And it's understandable. It's easy to understand why the Ukrainians have such a dislike for the Russians, to the point that the Ukrainians actively collaborated with the Nazis during World War II, and why some of the elements that are leading the fight against the Russian-backed rebels today are neo-Nazi units who proudly wear the swastika. Again, check the show notes for a link to Doug's website, faith-happens.com, and I'll also put a link to his new article at Skywatch Magazine, Why the Ukraine Conflict Could Lead to World War III. Interesting stuff, and something we've tended to forget about in the discussion about Iran as a nuclear threat. Refer to the interviews that I've done with Dr. Timothy Furnish if you want to hear why I tend to think that that's been overblown. Frankly, Republicans who, in talking about the Iranian deal, and let's discuss that for a moment here, have been slamming this as a bad deal. And please understand, I recognize that Iran is a threat to Israel. I don't know if they're an existential threat, but they certainly get a lot of mileage, the Ayatollahs do, out of demonizing Israel. It always helps when you're running a government to blame an external enemy for all of your problems. It helps keep the natives from getting too restless if you can point them to an external enemy. And Israel certainly serves that role for the Ayatollahs. But I do think that the Ayatollahs are smart enough to realize that if they tried to nuke Israel, they'd wind up in charge of nothing but a pile of radioactive rubble. And they aren't that stupid. At least I don't think they are. And there are some reasons to believe they've got religious reasons not to do it. But again, look up at VFTB.net, the interview with Dr. Timothy Furnish on the interview regarding Iran and what it might want to do with a nuclear weapon. Now, the deal with Iran, I don't think that there's much that we could do in the West or the United States. As much as we like to think that we're, Big Daddy from Cincinnati, there's not a whole lot that we can do to really compel or force Iran to give up the idea of attaining a nuclear weapon if they really, really want to get their hands on one. If we do nothing, they get a nuclear weapon. If we threaten war, which is what some of the hawks in Congress have been doing, that just convinces the hardliners in Tehran that they really need a nuclear weapon to protect themselves. If we negotiate, then maybe we slow things down, and supposedly this deal will delay an Iranian nuke by up to 10 years. I don't think that will happen. I am pretty sure that this deal will not do what the president is telling us that it's going to do. I think it's naive to think that the Iranians are negotiating in good faith, but I really don't know what the options are, to be honest with you. And frankly, I don't think Republicans do either. And that's why they're saying, well, no deal is better than a bad deal. Well, really? Okay. It's because they can't come up with a better suggestion. And what they've done in negotiating, and this is the aspect or one aspect of this whole process that really bothers me. The United States Constitution stipulates that foreign treaties must be approved by a two-thirds majority of the U.S. Senate. So how have we gotten to a place where instead of a Senate approving, you know, considering this treaty to approve it or turn it down, the Congress is going to vote after 60 days of review as to whether they want to disapprove the treaty. How does that happen? The Constitution says very clearly the president can make treaties with the advice and consent of the U.S. Senate, and that a two-thirds vote of approval is required. But instead, the Republicans who controlled both houses of Congress passed a bill 2 months ago reserving for themselves only the right to review this deal for 60 days and then vote whether they want to disapprove it. President Obama has made it very clear he will veto any vote in Congress that gets in the way of implementing this deal. To override a presidential veto, you need a two-thirds vote. That means for this deal to pass, the bar has been lowered from 67 senators to 34 senators, from two-thirds to one-third. The Republicans are saying, and John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, said the Republicans will do everything that they can to block this bill, to block this treaty from taking going forward. Except, apparently, abide by the constitutional responsibility delegated to the Senate. Now, this may well be a bad deal, but the Republicans have, in very cowardly fashion, refused to assume the responsibility under the Constitution that they are obligated to accept, and politicked this situation so that all they can do is vote, and all they need to do is get a majority, which they probably will, to vote thumbs down on this deal. But they probably won't get a two-thirds majority to vote thumbs down on this deal. Which means when the president vetoes the deal, the Republicans will put up their show of a fight, their play-acting of a fight, and because they won't be able to muster a two-thirds vote to override the veto, this deal with Iran will go through. And then the Republicans, when the deal goes bad, which it may well, the Republicans can say, well, we did everything we could to try to stop it. It's not our fault. Blame President Obama. Blame the Democrats. That's what's going on with this deal. And frankly, on something as important as this, it turns my stomach a bit. And you know, conversations like this one, discussions like this, which I had when I was hosting the Daily Radio Talk Show back in Columbia, Missouri, back in 06 and 07. It's why our consultant, he accidentally copied me on an email that he wrote in anger to our station manager, called me an NPR liberal. Yeah, the pro-gun, anti-abortion type. But this is politics pure and simple. I mean, I'm no constitutional lawyer, but I've got pretty good reading comprehension. And as I read it, this is a treaty with a foreign government negotiated by the president. The Senate must consent to it by two-thirds vote. But instead, they've somehow passed a bill delegating this. And what this does now is it sets a precedent. The next president who comes along says, well, look, you did it on this deal. This is the same kind of thing here. So we don't need the Senate to approve this next treaty that we're going to conduct. And another piece of the United States Constitution falls into the dustbin of history. Also in the news this week, an undercover video camera by a journalist representing the Center for Medical Progress apparently caught a representative, the top doctor. I mean, just not a representative, but the top medical doctor for National Planned Parenthood, eating a salad and drinking wine at a meeting over lunch or dinner and very casually discussing how partial birth abortion techniques would be used to harvest fetal body parts, you know, to preserve as many of the parts as possible for sale into the biomedical research field. It's frankly nauseating. Planned Parenthood responded and said, well, it was heavily edited, blah, blah, blah. But frankly, when you look at the full video, which you can find at the website of the Center for Medical Progress, like an hour and 6 minute video, something like that, you can see that it's not been edited to change the context or the content of the conversation. So if the party in the video is in fact the top medical doctor for Planned Parenthood, then it seems pretty clear that Planned Parenthood is in the business of trafficking in fetal body parts for profit. Which begs the question is why the federal government, why any government agency in the United States is providing funding for Planned Parenthood as though it were a nonprofit organization. This is not a nonprofit organization. In fact, when you look at their tax records, which by law they have to publish on the on their website, or at least make public, and you can access those, they show, and I forget what the euphemism is they use, but essentially it's the difference between the money they took in and the expenses per year. I mean, it's declared there on their public statement. And there's generally a positive number there. And that is what we in the business world used to call profit. And usually it's a pretty healthy number. So anyway, I would hope that this would cause enough of an outcry that at the very least, our tax dollars would quit being sent to this particular organization, this odious group of people who are in the business of sexualizing our children and then profiting from their decisions to try to correct those errors. The children in our society today have become a burden, apparently. They're not a blessing from God. They are a burden to be excised and removed. Vox Day, who's a rather outspoken, sometimes a little too sharp for, in my opinion, for one who calls himself a Christian. But anyway, I thought made a very insightful observation today that we are not the United States. We are not the new Rome as we once envisioned ourselves to be. We are the new Carthage. And of course, Carthage was the city-state defeated by Rome in war. And maybe the Roman historians colored their accounts because they wanted to demonize the longtime enemy of Rome. You know, Carthage gave Rome fits for a long time. And to the victors falls the right of writing history. But Roman historians remembered that the Carthaginians turned the practice of child sacrifice to their god. They called it Cronus, but it was identified by the Romans and the Greeks with Baal, Himon, and also with Molech. And they had turned it into an almost with clockwork efficiency. And you can find artist representations of it if you search Carthage child sacrifice, how the child was placed in the arms of the idol representing Moloch or Cronos or Baal Himon, and then the child lowered into the flames. Moloch, of course, mentioned in the Bible many times as an idol, the national god of the Ammonites, to whom at least a couple of the Jewish kings, Manasseh in particular, son of Hezekiah, made their children pass through the fire, which again, a euphemism, which basically means sacrificed to the fallen angel. So anyway, those are the big items in the news this week. Still working on, off the cuff as far as the schedule goes here, and I do appreciate Doug being available. It's, again, this last three interviews, it's sort of been the Final Babylon week, is the three co-authors of Final Babylon. And it wasn't planned in advance. It just sort of worked out this way. Appear as guests here in a row. But we'll do my best to get somebody, a guest lined up for Sunday to try to continue this twice weekly schedule here on A View from the Bunker. On Sunday, for sure, I can tell you that we will have another Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, where we're going through the Bible in chronological order. We just completed the book of Leviticus, so we're into the book of Numbers now as the 12 tribes have organized or are in the process of organizing for war. And very soon we'll get to chapter in Numbers where we run into another account of the Nephilim, a report from the spies who are sent into the land of Canaan and manage to freak out the entire nation of Israel and keep them in the desert for another 39 years. But that will be posted Sunday morning at gilberthouse.org. The interview with Skywatch at Skywatch TV this week, the program this week, I was blessed and privileged to interview Gary Stearman about his book, Time Travelers of the Bible. And I've got to go back and listen to it again because the interview was done a couple of months ago as we tried to work ahead in order to accommodate building new studios here at Skywatch TV. I'd forgotten how interesting that conversation was and forgotten half the stuff that Gary had talked about in the book. It's really interesting, and Gary Stearman is unique in that he holds to a very conservative theological position on doctrines of sin and salvation and so forth, and yet is able to look at the Bible and pull things out of the text which, you know, aren't inventions out of thin air. I mean, they're there in the text, but it takes a mind that can think outside the box in order to put those pieces together. And when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. The Hebrew prophets shattered the barriers of time and space, traveled in time. And that interview is now available at YouTube. It's at the Skywatch TV. You can find it there. And you can also find it at the Skywatch TV Roku channel. If you have a Roku account, you can log on, search the channel store for Skywatch TV, and add the channel to your account. We've now passed over 10,000 subscriptions to the Roku channel, which is really phenomenal. But again, if you don't have a Roku account, it is posted to the Skywatch TV YouTube channel as well, and you can find that interview there. I think you really like it. The second part of the interview will air on the Christian Television Network this coming Tuesday night at 8:30 p.m. Central Time. That's UTC-5 on DirecTV 376, Dish Network 267, and Glorystar Satellite Channel 117. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. Remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.